Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon, your host, joining you from India. Today on Cure Talks, we are discussing Lyme disease. Lyme disease is an illness caused by the bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi, a complex microbe known as a spirochete. Lyme disease is a multi-systemic illness. If left untreated, it can become severely debilitating and can affect multiple organs, including the central nervous system, joints, heart, and brain. It presents in multiple stages from acute to chronic illness. The Global Lyme Alliance is pleased to present this talk with Cure Talks on the topic Highlights from the 18th Annual International Lyme and Associated Diseases Scientific Conference, an important conference bringing together leading physicians, scientists, and others with expertise in tick-borne diseases to share important research updates and other evidence-based clinical data with their peers. Today's talk will cover a summary of key data and information presented here. I welcome the experts on the panel, Dr. Kenneth Lina, a Lyme disease expert and also on the board of directors of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, the scientific advisory board of the Lyme Disease Association, among others. Dr. Samuel Shore, associate clinical professor, George Washington University Healthcare Sciences. Dr. Tom Moorcraft, board certified in family medicine and osteopathic manipulative treatment. Dr. Leo Shea, clinical associate professor of rehabilitation medicine at Rusk Institute. He also serves on the scientific and community advisory board for the study of Lyme disease at Stanford University Medical Center. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The patient panel leading the discussion today is Jackie Bailey and Jennifer Crystal. Jackie is nurse practitioner at Aphoresis Associates of Northern Virginia, and Jennifer is a writer and educator working on a memoir about her journey with chronic tick-borne illness. Welcome to Cure Talks, Jackie and Jennifer.
Thank you, Priya.
Yeah. We will now give you a brief outline. Of the talk format today. Jackie Bailey will begin with the discussion, followed by Jennifer Crystal. Towards the end of the talk, we will be taking in questions from the audience. The dial-in to ask your question live is 718-664-6574. I repeat, 718-664-6574. This number will be posted on curetalks.com webpage, and we will be repeating this number before we begin the QA. You can also post your questions in the comment section of the Cure Talks page or email me, priya@trialx.com, with the same. I once again welcome everyone to today's episode of Cure Talks. With that, I will now hand over to Jackie to begin with the discussion. Jackie, over to you.
Thank you, Priya. Yes, I'm a nurse practitioner in Northern Virginia as well as a chronic Lyme patient. I have the typical story of many Lyme patients in that I did not see a tick or have a bullseye rash. I didn't have a lot of the classic signs and symptoms that I learned about in school, such as Bell's palsy or swollen knee. So it took many medical providers to figure out what was going on when I first presented. I had a false negative ELISA and a misdiagnosis. And then I was finally lucky enough to see a doctor who was well-educated about Lyme and testing. I've been treating for a year, and I'm doing great, and I'm transitioning to herbals now after a year of antibiotics. I really enjoyed attending the 2017 iLabs conference, and I have a few questions for our doctor panel. I was going to start with Dr. Legner. My first question is, during Dr. Mozzieni's presentation on Bartonella, he stated that some Western blots are only IgM positive, that are only IgM positive may actually be a Bartonella infection. Bartonella is a co-infection of Lyme disease, but it is common by itself as well. He went on to describe how both Bartonella and Lyme affect the nervous system as well as cause collagen damage. What measures can a clinician use to determine which infections their patient is dealing with? Or do we need to rely on empiric treatment until tests improve? Thank you.
Well, as with any medical condition, the eliciting the history is extremely important, both for Lyme and for Bartonellosis. And also, sometimes there are distinguishing features on physical examination that can point to one, you know, or another of these disorders. There's been a lot of attention to the unusual skin stria, which may be seen in Bartonellosis, and through the work of Dr. Mosiani and his collaborators, including Dr. Breitschwert, they recently have been able to really demonstrate that often these stria, when they are related to Bartonella, you really can prove that by doing biopsies and doing what's called immunohistochemistry and also PCR. So sometimes that can be a distinguishing feature. But as you mentioned, there can be quite a bit of overlap between Lyme disease and Bartonella, and it really can be quite confusing and sometimes can take a while to sort out. Let me just get back to you mentioned about the IgM Western blot. I presume you were talking about Lyme IgM Western blot, that mm-hmm. Dr. Mosiani is stating that can be falsely positive or positive in a nonspecific way in Bartonellosis. I don't know all of the rationale for Dr. Mosiani's observation. Certainly you can get false positive IgM Western blots in Lyme disease, not just for Bartonella, as Dr. Mosiani is stating, but also for other conditions, you know, acute conditions, acute viral infections can give you false positives. And sometimes the response to treatment and the application of treatment can help to tease apart over time what you're dealing with, because treatments that might work for Lyme disease might not be adequate for Bartonella. For example, amoxicillin is often very useful for Lyme disease, but in my experience, it hasn't been terribly helpful for Bartonellosis. So if you introduce treatment in somewhat of a staged or sequential fashion, you can sometimes tease apart what is responding to treatment aimed at Lyme disease and what might be responding to treatment aimed at Bartonella. Many of us would use a combination of either a tetracycline or a so-called azolide, such as azithromycin or clarithromycin, along with rifampin. And that combination, many of us find to be very useful for Bartonellosis, and sometimes you will see clinical features respond to that type of treatment that do not respond to just for Lyme disease. And for example, ceftriaxone, which many people use for serious cases of Lyme disease, isn't notable for its impact on Bartonella. So failure of some things to resolve with the ceftriaxone might suggest that there might be a Bartonella co-infection. And finally, there are direct detection methods, PCR, for example, that if one is fortunate to detect a positive, that can help you to know with more certainty whether you are dealing with either Lyme or Bartonella or both.
Thank you. And as a follow-up to that regarding Lyme Western blot, many patients who do have a positive IgM Western blot do not seroconvert to IgG positive. Why is this the case in Lyme disease, and why is it different from the normal immune response in other human infections?
Yes, you're exactly right. Many typical infections, when the person is first exposed, the immune response tends to be IgM. And then with the passage of time, and often as the infection is vanquished, the IgM shuts off, and there's what's called class switch to IgG. There is a common belief that in Lyme disease, one ought to ignore the IgM Western blot except in the first month or two of illness. The problem is that in many patients who have Lyme on a more chronic phase, that IgM persists, and not only that, often additional bands, including bands of very high specificity, will develop over time that makes me think it's very unlikely that the IgM reactivity is false. And, of course, there are other ways you can sometimes substantiate that by direct detection methods. The work of probably Nicole Baumgarth has probably been the most instructive into possibly explaining why that class switch from IgM to IgG does not occur, or often does not occur, in Lyme. In a mouse model of Lyme, she's demonstrated that the Borrelia infection completely disrupts the normal architecture of the lymph nodes and what we call germinal centers. That architecture is very important in the normal development of the immune response, with different cells of the immune system being organized in three dimensions and presenting antigens. And the germinal centers in this mouse model of Lyme, which are usually like kind of like little spheres sitting within the lymph node, those get completely disrupted and disorganized. And a lot of us suspect that that might explain why there often is this failure of class switch from IgM to IgG. And there probably are other reasons as well.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ligner.
Sure.
My next question is for Dr. Shore. After attending the most recent ILADS conference and during your term as ILADS president, can you let the patient community know what's new in terms of treatment of Lyme disease? Dr. Horowitz talked about his new Dapsone protocol at the conference. Can you tell us who would and wouldn't be a good candidate for treatment with Dapsone?
Sure. Use of Dapsone, which traditionally has been used for leprosy, can be used particularly for those recalcitrant patients who not only have Borrelia but often have the co-infection of babesiosis, which is a parasite in the red blood cells, and that it's not a first-line drug, but it has been shown when chosen carefully and monitored carefully, because anemia can develop, among other things, that it may be a useful add-on in a second or third-line priority. There are other interventions that were described in the conference. Of particular note was the evidence-based lecture of Dr. Leone, who discussed a number of the herbals that had anti-Borrelia activity and one with anti-Babesia activity. Artemisia has been shown to affect persister cells, which is a new and upcoming evolution of understanding why Borrelia can become chronic. But artemisia has been shown, at least in the test tube, to have efficacy against persister cells. Curcumin, another herbal, has been shown to have efficacy for Babesia. So these are just a few of the interventions described.
Great. Can we discuss the evidence of persistent Borrelia infection after antibiotic treatment found in the 2012 Monica Embers study of rhesus macaques, or the findings thus far of the NIH genodiagnostic studies, which were discussed at the conference briefly, or the Columbia postmortem studies? And I'm mostly interested in this because I want to know how I can determine if I'm still dealing with an active infection versus tissue damage or autoimmunity when I'm looking at my symptoms.
Right, and you've combined a couple of questions, so let me tease this out. In relation to the Monica Ember study, she is one of the cutting-edge researchers in the evaluation of non-human primates using the rhesus macaque monkeys. And the study to which you're alluding, the monkeys who were Borrelia naive, meaning that they were healthy beforehand, were infected with Borrelia-infected ticks. 4 months after that inoculation, they were treated with the equivalent of a human dose of doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice daily for a month. and 6 months after completion of the antibiotics, there was a feeding of Borrelia naive ticks that had not been fed before, so that to determine whether in fact there was an ongoing infection in these non-human primates. And in fact, in both the 3 and 6 month follow-up studies, evaluation of those fed ticks were positive. Many of them were positive PCR and culture positive for Borrelia. So that was consistent with the presence of circulating Borrelia infection in those monkeys that had been treated with what many consider to be an adequate treatment course for Lyme disease, obviously not the case in this setting. The animals, the monkeys were subsequently sacrificed 8 months after antibiotics, and her second study dealt with the multiple organ involvement on necropsy post. They identified evidence of infection in the brain, peripheral nerves, skeletal muscle, and the heart, among other locations. So this is very strong evidence that the antibiotics that are used for a month, at least the doxycycline course, in this setting was inadequate to clear the infection. With respect to how do you determine whether you've got an active infection or not, the first to set the stage for what is generally used, the technology traditionally used to test for Lyme disease is characterized as the two-tiered system. The first tier in that two-tiered system is a technology called ELISA, which is inexpensive and supposed to be sensitive. It's then followed by a confirmatory Western blot test, which is supposed to be more specific to the infection. Unfortunately, that there is a plethora of evidence in the literature to indicate that that technology approach is not very sensitive, and in some, on average, about 50% sensitive. In addition, it's measuring the body's immune or antibody response, and so that if it's positive, one can't definitively say that there's an active infection just from that test. All one can say is that there's been exposure to the organism. There is other technology that's available that unfortunately is not very sensitive, that if positive, generally it would be consistent with an active infection. And Dr. Ligner alluded to PCR, which measures the genetic material of a particular organism. In this setting, we're talking about Borrelia burgdorferi. There also is availability of culture, but neither one of those are very sensitive. There was new technology that was discussed at the conference that is promising, but I'm not sure ready for prime time. Nanotrap is a urine antigen test. The antigen is the protein representative of the infection, so that if present would be consistent with an active infection. There was discussion by Dr. Fallon of the metagenomic sequencing of multiple pathogens, which holds a significant promise, but again is early in its development. Then there's the stimulation of what we call T cells, which are a part of the immune system that can be stimulated even earlier than antibody production, and that seems to be promising as well, but that's early research. And then there's work being done by John Alcott's group to measure immune markers called chemokines and cytokines that are associated with the infectious process, but that has also to be clarified as to what role that will play in the diagnostic paradigm that we seek.
Thank you. That was a lot of good information. Dr. Moorcraft, I have
Hi,
a question
good evening.
For you next. Good evening. Can you address the role of both heavy metals and mold, mycotoxins in the clinical picture of a chronic Lyme patient, and what can be done to address these environmental toxins?
Well, I think these are, you know, two really sort of important, you know, pieces in the role of treatment of chronic Lyme, because I think, you know, rightfully so, we need to focus on these persistent infections because we've learned so much about how they, you know, all the different mechanisms they have for evading our immune system and such. But, you know, in most of the patients I see, there's more than one factor at play, and that could be a co-infection like Lyme and Bartonellosis. But often, you know, we have Lyme and Bartonella as well as heavy metals and maybe some mold toxins. So there's usually a combination. And what I find both with the mold and the heavy metals is primarily boils down to an inflammatory response. And I kind of look at things where, you know, we're trying to find the root cause of the illness. And so in any event, that root, whatever that root cause is, could be, you know, creates a toxic effect on the body. And these toxic effects really just are the things that are generating inflammation. And inflammation is that piece that leads to, you know, the signs and symptoms that all of us have, you know, come to find, you know, to know as associated with these diseases. So, for example, like in heavy metals, you know, mercury and lead are really commonly elevated. And I really try to make a distinction between an acute toxicity event, which is one thing, and what I typically see, which is a chronic burden, which would be more like if you think about the kids who go to kindergarten with a backpack, they might have a lunch in it or a pair of gloves, but by the time they're in middle school, they've got 40 or 50 pounds of books in their backpack. And so those heavy metals are kind of weighing them down. And it's, you know, you can suppress immune function, you can see decreased nerve conduction velocity. So, you know, a lot of our patients with brain fog and just sort of this inability to heal, there's sort of an Achilles heel. Heavy metals can be part of that. There's also some work that's been done on cryptopyroluria, and it looks like some major physical stressors or emotional stressors, including, you know, chronic infections, can trigger this genetic pathway that leads to us losing some minerals and vitamins at a faster rate than we would have if we didn't have Lyme. And so in turn, often we find those patients having elevated levels of metals. And it, so it seems like if this is turned on, rather than putting the minerals back into the tissues and the bone, we're actually putting the heavy metals in, which then, so a lot of our patients with Lyme disease end up having, you know, heavy metals at a much higher rate. And when we look at the mold and mycotoxins, I think we have two sort of major things going on out there. And one is you can fight, have mold and then have a mold exposure, and you may have a difficult time detoxifying the mold toxins. And the other one is that you can become chronically colonized, and we generally are looking at places like the nasal sinus cavities, or as Dr. Brewer talks about, or also in the gut. So these are kind of the major pieces we're looking at, and they're, in either event, if it's just the difficulty detoxifying because our human leukocyte antigens aren't doing their job properly, kind of like Dr. Shoemaker talks about, or if it's a colonization or a little bit of both, it boils down to we need to really get people out of this environmental exposure. And, you know, like mold, you might need to move out. And if we look over at heavy metals, we might actually have to think about maybe removing mercury amalgams if that's the case. And then we need to detox our patients, and there's many different ways to do that. And one of the, I think the key pieces that we see across all of these treatment protocols is once we start to detoxify the patient, we also need to bind them. You'll see a lot of use of cholestyramine and activated charcoals, and there's a whole bunch of other types of binders that have been coming out to really suit the needs of our chronically ill patients. But there needs to be a binding so that we don't just dump the toxins into the colon and reabsorb them. And then another piece that I always try to, you know, help people understand is that our bodies are fantastic at healing, and our lymphatic system, you know, really relies a lot on movement. So any kind of movement, you know, even you see people walking and rebounding or, you know, just kind of up and down. If you can do a little more activity, that's good too. But anything that's going to get you breathing a little heavy, moving the arms and legs to really take advantage of the natural detoxifying systems in the body are also going to be things that are helpful in these situations.
Thanks. You also spoke at the conference about the importance of sleep. And in talking with the other patient moderator on this call, Jennifer Crystal, we both noted insomnia as a major part of our presentation with tick-borne disease. How can Lyme patients improve their sleep, and what can be done if herbal and prescription sleep aids fail?
That's a great question. Sleep is so important to healing, and I think my patients frequently have the same experience that both you and Jennifer have had with insomnia being a huge piece. So from a sleep perspective, certainly prescription sleep aids can be helpful. I often find that they create more trouble than they're worth in my particular patient population, but I do use them, and there's a myriad of different ones that work on different receptors. And certainly working with your doctor to go through those, if they're appropriate, could potentially be helpful. I kind of find if you try two and they haven't really worked, it's probably not going to end up working from the pharmaceutical perspective. From the perspective of some of the herbal or natural things you can do, people talk a lot about the use of melatonin, which is a sort of a natural hormone that our brain makes, a little gland called the pineal, and it helps regulate our circadian rhythm and such. The problem is a lot of people do get a lot of grogginess in the morning once they are sleeping with melatonin, and I've actually found that liposomal versions of melatonin seem to alleviate that morning grogginess, and that's been very successful for our patients. People can also think about using things like 5-HTP, which is a precursor to serotonin, because serotonin then leads to the production of melatonin. Additionally, GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, so it kind of puts the brakes on the brain and lets you kind of take the edge off of some anxiety, and people can calm down that way, and it can help induce sleep. Inositol is also another thing that works really well that way. And one tried and true trick a lot of people like is just a little bit of magnesium at night. It's good to calm the muscles down and help with spasm and a little bit of pain, but also it's very calming to the nervous system. But when those things don't work, one of the things I ask a lot about is just like when people get up, if they're able to fall asleep, but they're waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning, oftentimes what happens is that they actually are hypoglycemic. They have low blood sugar. They have to release some cortisol so that they can mobilize some of the body's stored sugars. And one way to combat that, instead of having to be hungry in the middle of the night, would be to have a sort of a light complex carb-based meal right before you go to bed. And there's lots of science behind this, and it's really nice. If you want your cortisol levels to be down, you have more carbohydrate. Just like in the morning, I tend to have like a lower carbohydrate, higher protein meal in the morning, and so that I can sort of allow my cortisol to naturally come up. And so as we regulate our cortisol both in the morning and the evening, that can be very helpful. Other tricks people can try that if they work for you, you can usually see results in a week or two, sometimes a couple of days. A lot of my patients are sensitive to Wi-Fi, and so I just have them put their Wi-Fi on a timer so that it gets turned off at bedtime and it turns back on in the morning. Some people will go through a little bit of a detox response over the first couple of days, and that clears out, and then they usually sleep a lot better. Another thing is we have a lot of lights on at night, so blue blocker lenses, which you can get on online outlets for anywhere from like $7 all the way up to designer kind, they're going to block the blue light. And, so you're going to have a little yellowish orange tint to what you're looking at, but it really helps preserve your natural circadian rhythm and your melatonin levels. And then there's certainly when things get out of control and you're really staying up all night, there's a thing called wake therapy, also known as sleep deprivation therapy, where people can basically count up the amount of time they're actually sleeping at night and then say, I want to get up at 6 o'clock. I only sleep 4 hours, so I'm going to bed at 2. And they basically make them, over the course of a week or two, they ratchet that back to a full 8 hours, and it's essentially exhaustion therapy. I don't find we have to go there too much by trying some of the other tips we talked about. So there's some things that I've found that can be pretty helpful in our chronic Lyme patients.
Great. That's some great advice. All right. Next, Dr. Shea.
Yeah.
After seen many medical providers to get a diagnosis. I, like many other patients, was told my symptoms could be psychosomatic and to go see a psychiatrist. I was very frustrated, but I did decide to go, and luckily I did because it was the psychiatrist who, upon listening to my symptoms of body aches, fatigue, and insomnia, who diagnosed Lyme disease and confirmed it via Western blot. What are some of the key psychological presentations that you look for with tick-borne diseases? And further, what signs and symptoms should a parent look for in a pediatric patient?
Well, I think that it needs to be broken down into kind of three different areas. One is cognition, or how one thinks. Another one is emotion, or how one feels. And the third is behavior, how one acts. Typically, in an adult population, after or even prior to a diagnosis, a person is feeling out of sorts and generally goes to have their organic capacities evaluated, and that can result in an individual being diagnosed either with the illness or not having a diagnosis and being told to go to a psychiatrist. The question of going to a psychiatrist on that basis is whether the psychiatrist is in fact a Lyme literate psychiatrist and has an understanding of the organicity of Borrelia burgdorferi or the other tick-borne illnesses. And if not, then you can get into some difficulty. But if they do, and you obviously were lucky enough to meet a psychiatrist who is knowledgeable of that, they typically will recommend, depending upon what they see, whether it's a cognitive process or an emotional process, a course of medication and then also a neuropsychological evaluation to better define what the cognitive or how the cognitive domains have been affected. In cases of pediatric cases, one of the things that one has to look for is information that is provided by the parent about the change in a child's study habits, the change in a child's behavior. And if the parent does not see that, and many times there can be diverse reasons for why a family unit does not recognize that. There may be some difficulty within the family unit. There may not be a good communication sense. But the school may represent complaints that show that the child in their report card or in their behavior has declined from where they were. And at that point, what very often happens is the school recommends that a parent have a child be seen for an evaluation, usually a cognitive evaluation. That can be done by a school psychologist, but most often what happens if the school psychologist is not aware of a tick-borne illness or the presentations of a tick-borne illness, the typical thing that happens is the child is declared as having attention deficit disorder, and if it's a behavioral thing, the diagnosis du jour is bipolar disorder or emotionally disruptive disorder or emotional discontrol. Most often, pediatric cases that have a diagnosis of Lyme disease and multiple co-infections do not have a diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. It happens to be that because of the illness, there are attentional traits which decline, but that does not diagnose them as an attention deficit disorder. But more often than not, when school psychologists see this, the typical diagnosis is attention deficit disorder, which is an incorrect diagnosis for the children, and it leads to incorrect treatment.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the family unit. The support of my family was a huge factor in my improvement thus far, and I'm aware that some patients do not have the same family or social support and feel isolated or abandoned. Why does Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses affect human relationships, and is there a role for family therapy?
Well, my axiomatic thought on this is Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases are a family illness. They're not an individual illness. An individual may bring the illness and be first diagnosed. But the likelihood is that there are other members of the family that will have it also, because they typically live within the same environment, they vacation in the same environment, and while they not have not been diagnosed, there is a likelihood that they may have it. That being said, if only one person in the family has a diagnosis, that immediately causes changes in all of the roles of the family members. That individual becomes the focus of attention, and that can cause problems between spouses who may feel that one may feel that the child is being pandered to. Children and siblings may feel that that child is getting too much attention and they're not being paid attention to, and therefore they go and seek other kinds of support systems, which can be detrimental. Anytime that I have an individual who is diagnosed with Lyme disease and lives within a family structure, I always ask for a family meeting and generally suggest that they have family therapy. Part of that is psychoeducational, so that everybody in the family is on the same page and they understand not only what presently is happening, but what will happen in the future. And it's to provide them both insight as well as hope. And I teach that here at NYU Medical Center to all the interns, because I'm the co-director of family therapy here. And it's very important for them to understand that when an individual has an illness, it becomes an illness that changes the roles of the family or the peer group in which they function. And if one does not have a family member, a singular person, they typically have friends, or if they don't have a collection of friends or can't feel they can reach out to them, there are support groups available that they can go to.
Thank you. And thank you to all the doctors for your answers. Next, I'm going to introduce our next patient, moderator Jennifer Crystal. Jennifer, can you please tell us a little bit about your experience with Lyme disease?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, and welcome to the doctors. I've been a patient of tick-borne illness for 20 years, though the illnesses were undiagnosed for the first 8 years of that process. I've battled many of the worst physical and neurological symptoms of Lyme, babesia, and Ehrlichia. After a severe relapse about a decade ago, I've moved from bedridden to remission, and though I still have some limitations, I'm grateful to now be living a relatively normal life that includes writing, teaching, exercising, and socializing. I write a weekly column for the Global Lyme Alliance, and I'm completing a memoir about my medical trajectory. I love being able to connect with other patients through my writing and also enjoy serving as a communication liaison between doctors and patients. I'm really excited to join you all today and to ask some questions, as Jackie did, about what I learned from your panels at the ILADS conference. So I'll just, to jump off of Jackie's questions, I'm going to start with a question for Dr. Ligner. The first is that different doctors at ILADS focused on research and treatment of co-infections, one of which has been mentioned before, which is Bartonella. And just for listeners just listening in, co-infections are other infections that other than Lyme disease that you can get from a tick bite. Can you talk about what you learned at the conference about various co-infections and how those findings might inform your treatment of other infections?
Thank you, Jennifer. Well, there was quite a big focus at the Boston conference on relapsing fever. There were three different speakers who gave excellent presentations. And by the way, I just want to comment that there were some 50 different presentations. A lot of them were given during parallel tracks. So just by attending, you couldn't go to all of them at the same time. Unfortunately, we got PowerPoints and able to review them. But there was quite a richness of the offerings there, and a lot of them were of very high quality. In terms of the co-infections that I commonly encounter that are most problematic for me, it's Lyme, Bartonella, and Babesia. Those are the kind of the three big ones, because each of them has a penchant for persistence. But in terms of what was focused on at the conference, like I said, there was quite a focus on relapsing fever. Sally Cutler, who's from Great Britain, gave a great talk on relapsing fever in Africa and worldwide. Dr. Ogo from Nigeria talked about relapsing fever in Africa. Diego Cadavid gave a great talk on the pathology of relapsing fever. So we've learned fairly recently that in addition to the Lyme organism, there's another Borrelia that is fairly common in the same ticks that can transmit Lyme, that is to say the deer tick, but it turns out it's not Lyme, and that the name that's been given to that is Borrelia miyamotoi, which was first described in Japan in 1994. And there's an entomologist currently at Yale, Derland Fish, who many years ago perceived correctly that there was another Borrelia in the deer tick, and he tried to get people's attention. He's quite well connected in the biomedical research establishment, and he basically got ignored until about 10 or 15 years ago in the former Soviet Union. There were human cases of that described, and all of a sudden there was a lot more interest. And in the last number of years, there's been more support and research on Borrelia miyamotoi. There was a case that was described in western New Jersey in Hunterdon County of an elderly woman who had a meningitis, and they looked at her spinal fluid, and they were able to see numbers of Borrelia in the spinal fluid, and that's unusual for Lyme, because Lyme is usually not present in large numbers. The relapsing fever organism, like Borrelia miyamotoi, are often in the blood, for example, in large numbers, where they can be fairly readily seen under light microscopy. Anyway, that case was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine not too many years ago. So there's been a lot more focus on that. the treatment for relapsing fever Borrelia, that is to say Borrelia miyamotoi, is similar to Lyme, although there's less known about the natural history of Borrelia miyamotoi relapsing fever than there is of Lyme disease. And the other thing about relapsing fever, in other parts of the world, and even in the American West, a different kind of tick typically will carry the relapsing fever organisms, what are called soft ticks. In the West, Ornithodorus, and in Africa, there's many other, they call them argacid ticks. Those ticks, unlike the deer tick, which attaches and stays on for days at a time, these other ticks, they feed very briefly, so they often will bite people during their sleeping time, and they won't even realize that they have had a tick attachment. Another thing about relapsing fever in Africa, the borrelioses in Africa are not what we call reportable diseases. Like in this country, Lyme is a reportable disease, but in Africa, it's not reportable. And there's much more focus in Africa on other infections, vector-borne infections like malaria. So what Dr. Ogo pointed out was that oftentimes people will have high fever, and it will be assumed that they have malaria, and they'll be treated as for malaria, but the infection won't respond because it's actually a borreliosis, and that's a big problem. I didn't see too much at the conference about babesiosis, but that's also a very big problem, and the treatment of that is quite different than the treatment of Lyme disease. Did I answer your question, Jennifer, or is there? Focus on more.
No, that's great. It's just so important for patients to hear about these other diseases other than Lyme, to know about them, and also to know about how these are issues worldwide. So that's very helpful.
Yes, these are
question. Sorry,
sure.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, please.
No, I agree with you. This is both Lyme disease and the relapsing fever borrelioses are global phenomena. It's not just in the United States or a single continent,
and not just in New England, as many people think.
Not at all.
Right.
I think almost every state in the United States has had cases reported. I'm not sure. Maybe Hawaii might be one state where it hasn't been reported. I'm not sure about that. I thought it was like almost every state has been reported.
It's so important for everyone to hear that. Another question I wanted to ask you is that during a panel Q&A at the conference, you mentioned that Lyme is variable, and I know this is true for other tick-borne diseases as well, that some people are devastated by it and some people are able to keep it in check. This has certainly been true from my own experience. I personally was devastated by it, but I know other patients have had an easier time fighting it off, and others have been even more severely debilitated than I was. Can you speak to why Lyme is so variable?
Well, for one thing, it's been recognized that there are many different strains of Borrelia burgdorferi, and some of the strains may be, as we say, more virulent, or some of them may focus on different organ systems, such as the nervous system or the heart. So part of it is, you know, what strain, you know, happens to infect you. And then to make things more complicated, people who live in you know, tick-endemic areas or tick-infested areas, I should say, you know, they often get bitten by more than one tick, and it's very possible that more than one strain can infect them and affect them. Then on top of the different strain variations, each human person obviously has a different immunogenetics, and it's been very well demonstrated in a mouse model. In fact, Dr. Cadavid, talking about relapsing fever, was pointing out that, you know, some strains of mice can be infected and have a very, very mild illness, and other strains of mice have a devastating illness. And Janice Weiss, who's a PhD at the University of Utah, has also shown very similar things for Lyme disease. Depending on the strain of mice, or mouse, I should say, some can have a very mild illness, and some can have a devastating arthritis that completely, you know, incapacitates the animal. So, you know, strains of mice can be inbred, and you can sort things out, you know, and look at the different strains. And in human beings, each of us has a very complex immunogenetics, and that's why it makes it very difficult to make blanket statements about what Lyme is or how it presents, and also how it needs to be treated in any given person. Mm-hmm. So many of us have found that you really do have to individualize the treatment, find out, you know, how intensive the treatment needs to be for a given person. Some people respond very well to rather simple treatment, and others require combinations of agents, and some require parenteral, which means either intravenous or intramuscular therapy. So it's not like one size fits all. You can't just say, well, everybody should be treated with this or everybody should be treated with that. And then every person, not only their immunogenetics affect how they respond to the infection, but also their immunogenetics determines how they handle the different treatment options, how their liver, you know, metabolizes different antimicrobial agents or other supplements. So you really have to be thoughtful and devise a plan, but also whatever plan you devise, you have to be willing to realize that you might have to devise the plan depending on whether the patient tolerates the treatment, whether it's having a good effect or a bad effect, and it requires a lot of improvisation, hopefully informed improvisation and thoughtful, but you just can't make a blanket statement about how everybody should be treated, because everyone's different.
Mm-hmm. That's so important for listeners to hear. Thank you so much, Dr. Lichtner.
Surely. Thank you.
My next question is for Dr. Shea. Dr. Shea, at the conference, a few doctors spoke to the fact that neurological and psychological manifestations of Lyme are secondary to the disease, meaning that they are effects of Lyme, but not the root cause of a patient's problems. This is an important reminder for me as a patient who has had to define that difference for others and recognize it for myself. Can you speak to that a little bit about the fact that those manifestations of Lyme are secondary to the disease and not the root cause?
Well, I certainly can speak to the psychological components. It depends upon whether, of course, the individual brings a psychological a component to the disease, or the disease brings it to the individual. That's a whole different question. But more often than not, what happens is the disease occurs, and then as a result of that, certain psychological components sally forth, and that could be a result of the organic effects of the disease, or it could be a characterological makeup of the individual and being able to deal with the disease. So what most often happens is that the disease, as it continues, takes a toll on the individual's stamina, and that takes a toll on their mental health. There are also neurological components of it that interfere with the cognitive aspects, how a person functions, so that their attention may be off, their memory may be off, their executive functions, their ability to multitask. And when an individual recognizes those things, and that is more secondary than primary, because often they don't recognize them immediately, but when they do recognize them and become aware, then they become more concerned about the problem, and that concern translates itself into anxiety and depression. And therefore, it's important at that point to make sure that an individual gets an intervention which is psychological in nature, meaning either individual psychotherapy or individual, if it's cognitive, individual cognitive mediation. But really, the way to know that is to have a full neuropsychological evaluation done, because that will evaluate the level of cognitive impairment. It will also evaluate the level of emotional impairment. And it will ask questions around how one deals with that, which is the behavioral signs. And having had that done, then you can target a treatment protocol, whether it be individual psychotherapy, if those are the primary responses to the disease, or if it's cognition, then that would be the way one would direct their therapy. It's never one or the other. It usually is a combination of both cognitive problems, and those cognitive problems exacerbate the psychological aspects of a person's functioning. There may be times when a person has a primary psychological problem that then opens up questions about cognition. But in this disease, it's much more often that a person has the cognitive component, and then that bothers them and either affects their work or their school process, and that then causes a decline in their ability to function psychologically.
That's great. Thank you so much, Dr. Shea. My next question is for Dr. Shore. Dr. Shore, one of the reasons my own case of Lyme went undiagnosed for so long is because testing is so faulty. And Dr. Ligner spoke to this a little bit before. Can you explain to listeners why current tests are so unreliable, and also talk about the latest research on diagnostics that we learned about at the conference?
Right. As it turns out, there was overlap between your questioning and your colleague's questioning. So I've answered much of this, but to reiterate the high points and a couple of other comments, one is the emphasis is that the two-tiered system that I mentioned earlier is not very sensitive. If we're lucky, it's 50% sensitive. So every other individual with real Lyme disease undergoing this paradigm of testing is going to be told by their clinician that the test is negative. And unfortunately, many clinicians take that as de facto ruling out Lyme disease. In fact, there's a law that was passed in Virginia 3 years ago that requires clinicians, when testing, to communicate that if the test is negative, it doesn't rule out the disease. They need to be followed clinically. In addition, it's testing the immune response, the antibody response. And paradoxically, the sicker an individual is with Lyme disease, which can adversely impact immune function, the more likely their blood test is going to be negative using this paradigm, as opposed to some of the other technologies about which I mentioned earlier. So the sensitivities of the paradigm are poor to begin with, and they're even that much more insensitive or less sensitive in the sicker individuals. And I talked about newer technology a moment ago.
Mm-hmm. So on the flip side of that, of diagnostics, what new research is being done on prevention?
Well, the major discussion was vaccines, and there are human vaccines and that I'll talk about briefly, looking at different proteins on the organism Borrelia burgdorferi. There's, and I'm not sure this was discussed at the conference, but there's some discussion about vaccines for the saliva of the tick, because that is going to be a more broad spectrum coverage. Because one of the concerns that we have in relation to Lyme disease is not only the multiple strains to which Dr. Ligner alluded, but the fact that there are so many co-infections, and if you have a vaccine for one organism, you're not necessarily going to protect against others. But if you have a vaccine against the saliva that mounts an acute immune response at the time of the blood meal that's taken by the tick, there's a potential that you can have a more broad-spectrum response. Then there's the concept of immunizing the mice. There's a study being done in Massachusetts that because understanding the life cycle of Borrelia, where the tick, when it hatches, is sterile. It's not infected. It has to take a blood meal of usually small rodents and very commonly the white-footed mouse. And there are there's research being done to somehow sterilize the mice so that when the tick takes a blood meal, it's not necessarily going to become infected. So there is some exciting work being done.
That's very exciting to hear. Thank you so much, Dr. Shore, for filling us in on that.
Jennifer, thank you so much. We are almost, short of time now, so probably we'll just open it up for QA, take some patient questions. I know you have some more questions for Dr. Shore and Dr. Moorcraft, but based on time, I think we should take some patient questions right now. I will just open up for QA. If you have a question for the panel, please dial in using 718-664-6574, and you can press 1 on your phone keypads, and we will bring you on air to ask your questions. I want the expert panel to know that we have received more than 50 questions, and audience, it's totally mostly impossible to cover all the questions here. But what we'll do is we will try to pick up the common topics that have come up in the questions and get the panel to answer some of them quickly. We just need, doctors, we need very brief answers for this so that we can touch upon most of the topics that have been mentioned in the questions. So, Dr. Ligner, there's a question. Can Lyme disease cause dental problems?
I'm sorry, what?
Can Lyme disease cause dental problems?
That is a really good question, and I'm not sure I'm that well equipped to answer it. Certainly, it can affect the nerves that subserve the face and the teeth. And I have heard of patients complaining of dental issues that were attributed to Lyme. I don't think I can really answer that question from my own experience very well. So I'm sorry.
That's okay. Dr. Moorcraft, we have received a lot of questions on alternative and natural therapies for Lyme disease. Could you please educate us regarding available holistic and natural treatments?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think a lot of us know that, you know, a lot of our medications actually come from either, fungi or different herbals originally, and then we sort of synthesize them in a lab. And so if we look back at sort of cultures throughout the ages, they've been using herbals that have anti-infective, antimicrobial properties, you know, very successfully for a long period of time. And to kind of just quickly run through some of the things is, from an anti-infective perspective, we have the ability to use herbals in both teas and tinctures. They also come in capsule forms. And so there's tons of different things out there that a well-trained practitioner can help you with. Other parts that come along with all sort of the alternative and natural therapies tends to be a real focus on the immune system and regulating naturally the immune system. We know that approximately 70% of our immune cells live in the gut wall. So focusing on the microbiome, all the good and bad bacteria in the gut, as well as the fungus that are normally in our gut, is very helpful. We often can do this through dietary modifications and sometimes, you know, gentle dietary cleanses, and certainly there's all kinds of other things that can be done there. When we're looking at alternative and natural therapies, lots of people focus on different ways to naturally support detoxification, which can be anything from, you know, homeopathics to different nutritionals, depending upon if somebody may be deficient or not, antioxidants, such as glutathione, or some of the precursors to glutathione can potentially be very beneficial. Some of the old school treatments, like using, you know, Alka-Seltzer or, you know, another antacid to help lower, to increase the pH and lower the, you know, to the acidity of the gut. Epsom salts, baths sometimes are used. And then simple things like I sort of mentioned earlier, movement and taking advantage of the body's natural abilities, such as having a regular bowel movement and drinking, you know, good pure water, often will fall into that. And I think that's probably a quick summary of things that are out there. And, you know, if we had more time, we could dive much deeper.
Thank you, Dr. Moorcraft. Dr. Shaw, what are your thoughts on the possibility of eradicating viruses that interfere with Lyme disease treatments through supportive oligonucleotide technique?
Well, it's my perspective that viruses very often are dormant until there's an immune stressor, and the infection, Lyme disease, really Burgdorferi infection, creates that stressor, so that there are many viruses, including Epstein-Barr, EBV, which is classically thought of for mono, and other herpes viruses that become active when Lyme becomes active. And what I've found generally in the majority of cases, when I think that there may be viral involvement, that treating the underlying bacterial infectious process and in so doing allowing the immune system to become more healthy very often takes care of the viral load, so that we don't need to use antivirals. That being said, there are some people who have recurrent zoster or other cases, HHV6, human herpes virus 6, which independently can cause fatigue and other systemic symptoms. Sometimes people will need antivirals for those infections.
Thank you. Dr. Shea, I know you spoke about neurological Lyme, but there's a question from a parent who asks, it has affected my daughter's ability to learn, organize her thoughts, and process information. What can we do to help her?
Well, the first thing is we have to understand what are the components that she's talking about. And the only way that can be done is through a neuropsychological evaluation, which will look at the panoply of cognitive issues such as attention, concentration, the various types of memory, executive functions, multitasking. All of those things have to go into the development of a treatment plan. So in order for anyone to develop a treatment plan that's effective, they have to first have the neuropsychological evaluation to know what strengths the child has and what weaknesses the child has. The strengths often can be offsetting of the weaknesses if you know how to use them effectively. But certainly one of the things a parent can do is immediately look at the functional life of the child and ask about the consistency of the family pattern. So is a child eating every day at the same time? Are they exercising every day at the same time? Are they going to school every day at the same time? Or are they playing at the same time? Are they going to sleep every night at the same time? There has to be a consistent pattern within the child's functional life. That's the first thing that has to be implemented. The second thing then has to be within that consistent pattern of functionality. What do we then have to do to help the specific child in the areas in which they are failing? And if, you know, there's quite a difference between someone failing in history or someone failing in language than someone failing in mathematics. There are very different components of the brain that handle those areas. And so you need to know if those areas are presently in decline, how you can then implement either a psychopharmacological intervention, which might be a psychostimulant, or whether in fact, and that's not my preferred choice, but sometimes that's necessary, or whether you develop a behavioral pattern and a consistent pattern within the family that will support that child. And it takes a lot of work for a parent, one, to do that, two, to understand it, and three, to have the stamina to convince the child that consistency is the best path, because most often children don't like that kind of approach.
Thank you so much. Dr. Lee, a couple of people have wrote in asking whether Lyme disease patients can donate organs.
That is a great question. And personally, my own personal view is that that could well be unwise, because there is so much evidence of persistence that can occur that I don't know. I would be very circumspect about organ donation in people who certainly have active Lyme. And then once they've been treated, the question is, have you eradicated the infection despite the treatment? And as we're learning, Dr. Shore mentioned the recent article by Monica Ember's group that just was published in this past December, that despite application of doxycycline at a dose that many people assume to be curative, the infectious agent is still present. So I don't know if there's an official policy by, you know, those agencies that officially do organ donation. The same kind of question comes up with blood donation, too. If people have had Lyme disease and been treated for it, should they donate blood? I know that if a person has ever had babesiosis, I'm pretty sure it's forbidden for them to donate blood, or the blood banks won't accept it. And I'm not sure if there's a blood bank policy about blood donations from people who have had Lyme and been treated. Of course, that could really pose a big problem, because so many people have contracted Lyme. You start prohibiting them from donating blood, that you're not going to have many people to donate. I guess it's just a personal opinion. I would be very circumspect about organ donation in people who have had Lyme disease. That's my own opinion.
We have actually already crossed the time. Dr. Leigner, it would be great if you could just talk a little bit about ongoing clinical trials that Lyme patients need to keep track of, and then we can wrap up for today.
At the present time, I am unaware of any formal sponsored clinical trials for the treatment of Lyme disease right now. I think a lot of the so-called trials of treatment that are going on, or trying to expand the approaches to Lyme, are those that are being attempted often in the offices of frontline treating clinicians out of necessity. I think it's been many years since there have been any formal government-sponsored funded trials of different actual treatment methods. Now, there is funded research on in vitro, meaning in the test tube approaches. Now, for many years there was denial, complete denial, that there could be such a thing as persistent infection despite application of treatment. And in recent years, the evidence has become so overwhelming that it's obvious that it's a problem. And right now there are three excellent groups that are attempting to explore novel approaches. So far, that's been mostly in the test tube. There's Ying Zhang's group at Johns Hopkins has been doing excellent work. Kim Lewis at Northeastern University has been doing very interesting work. And also Jay Rajadas at Stanford. So what a lot of them have been doing is taking some of the things they've been doing is taking agents that are existing in the pharmacopoeia, meaning that they're already FDA-approved drugs, and trying agents that nobody would ever think before to use for Lyme disease, and just trying different agents, different combinations of agents, and finding things that are quite surprising actually have activity. So that's encouraging, and I think we may stumble upon something that really is very, you know, clinically useful. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, others have argued that we really need to not just use agents that already exist, but really with a deeper understanding of the biology of Borrelia and some of these other tick-borne diseases, really try to innovate with new approaches that can really – that are not just the common antibiotics or antimicrobials, but new agents that can really intelligently target some really strategic point in the – biology of these organisms that can really knock them out and result in a definitive cure. And of course, that's the goal. And the good thing is that that type of work is occurring. A lot of that work is being funded by private organizations, including the Global Lyme Alliance has been doing excellent choices on what to fund. So
thank you so much. I think there is a need for a more programs as this so that we can share and inform all the people who've been listening, Lyme disease patients and caregivers. It is certainly important to spread this information now. The CDC estimates that over 300,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with Lyme disease each year. And it is one of the fastest growing vector-borne infectious diseases in the U.S. and Western Europe as well as other countries. So I think all this information that we have shared today is absolutely invaluable. Thank you so much, Dr. Ligna, Dr. Shea, Dr. Moorcraft, and Dr. Shore. We had some more questions for you. Probably we'll try to get them answered from you for the audience at a later point. Jackie and Jennifer, great questions. Sorry, Jennifer, we could not complete your list of questions. Probably we'll have part two for this and get to them. And this talk will be made available on curetalks.com for replay. Please visit curetalks.com for details on all our upcoming talks. Thanks a lot. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.